Hi, my name is Chris Brennan, and you're listening to the Astrology Podcast. This episode is recorded on Wednesday, July 5th, 2017, starting just after 5.02 p.m. in Denver, Colorado, and this is the 115th episode of the show. For more information about how to subscribe to the podcast and help support the production of future episodes by becoming a patron, please visit theastrologypodcast.com/subscribe. In this episode, I'm going to be talking with astrologer Vic Dakara about the use of the tropical zodiac in Indian astrology. Vic, welcome to the show.
Thank you so much, Chris.
All right. So this is a topic. It actually came up last month. I interviewed Ernst Wilhelm, and we had a brief digression at one point, since one of the things that Ernst is known for is his arguments and his use of the tropical zodiac in Indian astrology. And that caught some of my listeners a little bit off guard, and we sort of glossed over the topic. But over the past month, I saw some of the debates that you've been having on the subject, and that you've actually talked quite a bit about it. So I wanted to have somebody on the show to talk about what the deal is with this, what the debate is about, and sort of outline it for, you know, most of my audience is Western astrologers, but there's obviously a lot of debate, even in the Western tradition, about the correct zodiac to use. So I thought you would be a good person to talk to about this debate in the Indian tradition. So where do we start, or where's the starting point for you?
That's really hard, right? Where to start? I think the best place to start is probably with your epistemology, because that's a real problem amongst astrologers. Because it's like in the old days, there were really, really brilliant people doing astrology, like Ptolemy and Galileo and Da Vinci. I don't know. You know, all the great scientists were doing astrology. So all the greatest minds were considering it. But I think since the Dark Ages and the Renaissance, that never really came back into focus. So it's actually pretty hard to argue anything, because people don't have the training, really, the intellectual training for debate or logic or even just the epistemology. I wonder how many people even know what the word means.
Sure. Yeah. And that's something, I mean, you argue, I mean, you've been making this argument. Maybe we should back up and just say, how long have you been studying astrology, or has astrology been in your life?
Directly on astrology for 10 years.
Okay. And somewhere around 2012, I think you said, that was when you sort of started studying the zodiac issue more deeply, or when you actually decided to make the change to using the tropical zodiac instead of the sidereal zodiac, right?
Right. That was exactly at the beginning of 2012.
Okay. And just to set the context, I mean, it's fair to say that at the present time, the majority of practitioners of Indian astrology or Vedic astrology, or whatever term you want to use for it, what term do you prefer for it, actually?
Well, it's just like so awkward not to say Vedic astrology, because everybody calls it Vedic astrology, although it's not Vedic astrology, you know?
Right.
It's not Vedic astrology, because Vedic astrology is a real thing. And this is, and what's done by Vedic astrology is not that thing. Mm. But it's just so commonly called Vedic astrology that it just seems like kind of a shame not to call it Vedic astrology. But you could call it anything you want.
Sure. I was watching like an interview with Jeffrey Armstrong recently, who was actually taking credit for that renaming of Vedic astrology a few decades ago or something like that. Do you know if that's true? I'm not actually familiar with what the history
is. There's always people, I don't want to, you know, I'm like Saturn. You have a poster of Saturn behind you. You're just looking also at Saturn right now. So there's so many people that say that they invented everything. Was Al Gore invented the internet or something?
Sure, sure.
So like everybody invented everything. Well, who knows who invented it? I don't really care either.
But generally, it's probably more of a recent term that's come into vogue, because astrologers in India just called it Jyotish, right? Until recently.
Yeah. Obviously, it's got to be recent, because it's only been recent that Indian astrology has come into the English-speaking world. So, and this is an English phrase. The actual term for it is Jyotish, which means science of stars. People go off on a big far, you know, people love to just make everything super spiritual and say it's the science of light. But it's called light because the dots of light in the sky are stars. Those are called the Jyotis. So it's the Jyotisha, the science of the stars.
Got it. Okay. And so it's fair to say that at the present point in time, that the vast majority of practitioners of Indian astrology use the sidereal zodiac, and the vast majority of Western astrologers use the tropical zodiac. So one of the things that interested me in this topic is that you're part of a relatively small, but I do want to say growing, sort of group of practitioners of Indian astrology that use the tropical zodiac, right?
Yeah.
Okay. What has that been like? Or, I mean, that must have been a big change for you, given that the majority of the current tradition, at least at the present time, of practitioners of Indian astrology, that's one thing I think everybody knows, is that they use the sidereal zodiac. So what prompted you to make that change?
God, it's also just karma and destiny. It's just my nature that I never really fit into any group that I'm in.
Sure.
So, you know, I never really subscribe completely to somebody else's idea, because my nature is to analyze things. So nothing is ever 100% perfect. So what it's been like, it's been a real pain in the neck, to be honest with you. It's a real pain in the neck to be a part of a group but not fit in that group.
Right. It's funny because that's why I'm interested in this. And I want to do another episode later this month contrasting another group, because you're a fringe group, which is within a fringe group, which is within another fringe group, in that you're an astrologer for one. So you're already sort of on the fringes of society on some level. Then you're a practitioner, a Western person or person from the West who practices Indian astrology, which at least in the Western astrological community would almost be another fringe group in some ways. I mean, I realize that's arguable depending on where you're at. But then within that, you've then joined a smaller fringe group where, compared to the majority of your other contemporaries, you're using a different sort of approach than they are, essentially, right?
Yeah. Yeah.
So,
and then just everything about me, as a vegetarian in Japan, punk rocker, hardcore punk rocker, Hare Krishna. It's like everything about me is like, who are you? You don't fit here. Go away.
Sure. So that's a recurring theme. So,
yeah.
I mean, and you came across this, and when you first came across the argument, because I came across the argument first about 10 or 12 years ago in the work of Ernst Wilhelm, and he was the person who initially influenced your sort of views on this, or that's how you got started as well to some extent, right?
He's the one who exposed me to the idea.
Okay. And what was that like initially? I mean, did you have reservations, or how was it reading? I think it was his paper, right? It's called the Mystery of the Zodiac or something like that.
Yeah. At first I just, you know, I was doing, this was back in 2007 or 8. So I was just doing as much reading as possible, and I was gobbling up all these books and having a real unsatisfying experience of reading a lot of books, because there wasn't, the best book that I found was Light on Life.
Yeah, by Hart Defoe and Robert Svoboda.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah. That was quite a good book. The rest of them were really hard to deal with. They were so disorganized and self-contradictory, and then contradicting each between each one, totally contradictory. Because also before I had come to astrology, I'd been doing, you know, practicing bhakti yoga and living in India and studying Sanskrit and all these things. So I had this background already of expecting things to be logical, because the Upanishads are all logical, the Vedic Shastras are logical, everything is logical. And so I expected that the Indian astrology would be similar, but it was all over the place and messy. But and nobody was actually studying or quoting anything. Nobody was actually referring to any standard text. Everybody was just giving their ideas. And that's so antithetical to the Vedic nature. The Vedic nature is always you reference the Vedas, or you reference some authority, or you reference some expert.
Sure. So there was more even drawing on like a contemporary tradition instead?
No, they don't. Well, they were just drawing on their ideas. Everybody was coming up with new ideas because this works for me. This worked, and this technique works. It's like people trying to practice medicine just by seeing what's going to work and not relying on what the previous doctors have discovered.
Okay.
So I was really taken aback by that, but then I found Ernst's writing, and he was actually looking at Sanskrit and translate, like Graha Sutras. He published Graha Sutras, which is selected to, shlokas from Brihat Parashara or Shastra, which is supposed to be the main astrological text for Indian astrology.
Mm-hmm.
And I thought, oh, this guy, at least I can relate to him. And I can see that he's actually studying something, so I'll take his ideas seriously. But then somebody told me, yeah, but he's crazy because he thinks that the zodiac is tropical. And I said, ooh, that does sound pretty crazy. But the rest of the stuff he says is good. So then it took about another 3 years, and I wasn't able to. There was a pretty terrible event in my life, and I wasn't able to foresee it at all. So I just reevaluated everything with him. Maybe this crazy idea from this guy Ernst, who has no other crazy ideas, well, actually, he has a few crazy ideas, but you know, who's basically a really cool. He's the most scholarly, reasonable person I found. Mm-hmm. Maybe this crazy, so-called crazy idea of his has some weight. Let me see why he's talking about this. So then I read that paper. I also just, because I'm in contact with him directly. It's not so hard to get in contact with people in astrology. The group is so small.
Sure.
And then I said, what's going on here? And then he just said, yeah, look at Surya Siddhanta. And it's just exactly the way that I want, the way that my mind operates. Refer me to an authentic statement. So he referred me to these authentic statements about the zodiac, defining the zodiac. And I said, oh, how can you argue with that? Then I start to try it. And then I said, oh, look at that. I would have foreseen this event. Oh, this makes sense now. That thing that I couldn't get to work before, I couldn't make sense out of this configuration before. Now it's gone. Mm-hmm.
So do you feel like that did clarify that specific event, though, that was the initial point for you?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
So, but initially, and that was what struck me when I first read Ernst's paper, is that initially it seemed like a textual argument, where it was an argument that after going back to the earliest texts, that it seemed like they were defining the zodiac tropically, much to everyone's surprise, and that was
right.
Part of his initial argument, which was almost like a purely textual argument, that the earliest Indian tradition seemed to be using the tropical zodiac, despite the sort of assumption up to this point that it had always been sidereal.
Right.
Okay.
Which is important to Indian traditions, because it's not, see, Western people and modern Indian people who are influenced by New Age philosophy will all be like, well, who cares? The textual, the books, who cares about books? You know, it's all what you think and what you feel and what works for you. But that's fine. That's a nice New Agey feeling. But that's not the Vedic tradition. That's not the Indian culture. The Indian culture is, what does it say in the Vedas? What does it say? What does an authoritative expert on this subject say? An ancient rishi or something? What does a seer say about this? So just saying that it's just a purely textual argument, to a Western mind, it seems like it's irrelevant. But in the context of what Indian astrology is supposed to be, a purely textual argument is the most important argument to make.
Sure, yeah. I mean, that's also the case, I think, in the Western with traditional astrology, is typically there's more... That's usually your starting point, is what does the tradition say? What do the ancient sort of sages or ancient masters of the art say? And that becomes more of a starting point. And usually that is more compelling to astrologers that are tied in with older or longer traditions, versus just something that's seen as new or an innovation often is viewed less authoritatively, sort of in contrast.
Yeah. Yeah, great.
Sure. Okay. So what are some of the textual, I'm trying to make sure we outline this correctly. So that's, the scope of it. What are some of the textual arguments then? Because I've seen that you sort of endorse and you follow some of the same, you point to some of the same texts that Ernst does in terms of substantiating this argument, right?
Yeah, because there's not that many texts to point to. I mean, how many times do you need to define something? So the Surya Siddhanta defines the zodiac in one place. Surya Siddhanta is the really like the Bible of Indian astronomy. Mm-hmm. And then there's the Puranas, and people who have no idea what the Vedas are about, but pretend to be yogis and things, they'll say, well, the Puranas are religious. And there's all this like anti-religion phobia also as well. If anything sounds remotely religious or dogmatic, then everybody runs away from it. Like, how can you say that you're right and somebody else is wrong? But the Puranas are not religious books. They're not Bibles and things like that. The Puranas are histories of Indian knowledge, records of Indian knowledge. And they have 10 key subjects. And one of the key subjects is astronomy. The configuration of the cosmos is one of the key subjects of a Purana. So in almost all the Puranas, you'll find descriptions of the stars, the planets, et cetera. So they also give a definition of the zodiac. And the really important thing is that it's not like you can pick out and you can find a tropical definition of a zodiac somewhere. If you look for it, that's the only thing you'll find. You won't find a sidereal definition of the zodiac anywhere in the Siddhanta or in the Purana.
One of the counter arguments that I have sort of thought of when I was looking at that argument was just, it seemed like some of those, like the Surya Siddhanta was a astronomical text for one, but it was also from the medieval period. and there seemed to be some back feed from the Western tradition. So to what extent is that authentically representing what astrologers during that time period are doing versus to what extent is that representing some possibly like Western astronomical theories that are influencing Indian astrology?
That's a good question. But then you come into this messy zone of like, okay, now you have to do your textual analysis. You have to get a critical edition of the text, right? And the way that any classical literature works is there's no printing presses. And printing presses is recent, and then digital is like completely recent. So the way books actually used to work is they weren't written in stone literally. They were just like, they were copied by people, and there were certain parts that would get updated and people would add in a comment here or there. So things weren't unchangeable. So when you do textual analysis of things, what you're really analyzing is what's the most recent copy that we have of something. Mm-hmm. When did it stop getting changed? So if you can date the Surya Siddhanta to a medieval period, and you can find a Greek influence or this or that here and there, it may have come in later. But that's also going to show you where did this come into India. You know, if the tropical zodiac is an influence from another culture, that's fine. But the Surya Siddhanta is the thing. It's the place where it got codified. So this shows how the Indians were using it.
Sure.
Once they were influenced by it, it shows how they were using it.
Right. Yeah. I mean, I guess that's just a question because in the Western tradition, it seems like there was some uncertainty for the first few centuries after Hipparchus, where Hipparchus's discovery of precession wasn't immediately adopted or endorsed by everybody, but it was just kind of like a theory and nobody was sure if it was correct. And the astrologers seemed to have not necessarily picked up on it fully until Ptolemy. And then Ptolemy becomes the first Western astrologer to both recognize that Hipparchus was right in the second century, but also to explicitly adopt the tropical zodiac, although he tries to allude to and say that he believes that this was the intention of the earlier founders of astrology as well in the Western tradition. We don't know, you know, that may or may not be the case. So in the Indian tradition, it's like one of the things that's tricky is in the Western tradition, we're able to look at charts like birth charts and see whether they're calculating them tropically or sidereally. Right. Do you know what the earliest charts are in the Indian tradition that survive in terms of that, where we could check and compare what zodiacs they're using?
No. But I'd like to say something. Can we come back to that exact question? Because in relation to what you said before, it is very, very interesting that the way that most of the world now knows about Indian everything is through the British, because the British sent everybody to India and started explaining all this stuff in English. So, for example, Surya Siddhanta is Burgess, Ebenezer Burgess, I think, is the main translator. Mm. He's a British person. And, you know, they were unabashedly condescending, actually.
Right.
It was very rarely were they complimentary to the things they were explaining or translating about Indian culture. So a lot of times they ignore things or, you know, pick out a flaw where it doesn't really need to be there. So the British translators doubted that the Indians exactly knew about precession. Mm. But it's obvious that they knew about something, about the reference point from the solar point of view, from the tropical point of view, from the length of days and nights, for that drifting in relation to the stars. The reason why that's obvious from very, very, very early times, the earliest record that we have is Rig Veda, which is like at least 3,000 to 5,000 years old. Mm-hmm. So the undeniable proof there is that they say that Kritika, the Pleiades, is the first of the stars. You know, Kritika is the first. But then in later texts, they change it to be Ashwini, which is some little stars in Aries. So, they're changing, they're updating their concept of what's the beginning and what's the end. And also, if you look in Puranas, they say that you need to draw a line from celestial north through these two stars of the Big Dipper. I'm not sure which ones they are, the two that rise first. I know them in Sanskrit, but Kalu and Kratu and Pulaha. Through these two stars, you draw a line from the north pole, not the north star, but the north pole, and where it falls on the ecliptic, that changes as centuries progress.
Okay.
Because the north pole is what trepidates. It doesn't trepidate, but it's what processes, right?
Right.
So they're talking about, they know about the Earth's tilts moving. And the reason why the British didn't like it is because they call it trepidation. They said it wasn't exactly precession. It was trepidation because it seems, they seem to think that it moves forward and then comes back. Whereas precession is just, it goes around like this, right?
Right. That it is just a constant forward movement rather than something that oscillates back and forth, which is one of the ancient theories. And
but the ancient theory of moving back and forth is based on this pole going through the North Pole going through the Big Dipper. That will trepidate. Because it's like a regression thing. It's like a retrogression thing.
Sure.
You see, so they just didn't figure it out enough. But the ancient Indians did know about precession of equinoxes. But they didn't measure it so much by how it's progressing along the whole circle. But they measured it by this line going through the Saptarishis, through the Big Dipper. And then but the question about the ancient charts, that's also a big problem. Because like I said in the beginning, there is such a thing as Vedic astrology, but it has nothing to do with the stuff that we're doing today.
Yeah, it's not horoscopic astrology, or it's not using birth charts, right?
Right. So the real old stuff doesn't talk about people.
I mean, that's a controversial point, though, in the Indian community, though, because, I mean, this is one of the issues when it comes to debates sometimes is, especially, you know, there's a debate about how old Indian astrology is, how far back it goes, does it have any reliance or influence from other traditions, and you know, did it exist in the Vedas? Does it go all the way back to, you know, 3000 BC or what have you?
Yeah, well, it definitely does.
So, or the entire thing does, or parts of it does?
Parts of it do. The Veda is textual, right? It's transmission of knowledge in words. So when you're going to use words, you have to supply people with a whole bunch of other things to know how to understand the words. So the Vedas come with these six appendices. They're called Vedangas. And there are things like, how do you pronounce these words? That's one of the appendices. How do you sing these things? What's the meters? What's the poetry? That's the second appendix. What do words mean? Dictionaries and things like that. That's the third appendix. How do words go together? That's grammar. That's the fourth appendix. And then you have to have, there's two more appendices for like, when do you do these things? The Veda is telling you how to do these actions to get certain results. When do you do them? And then there's two more appendices. Two of the six appendices are about that. One is called kalpa, which means, you know, when something happens, when you have a certain decision, when you have a certain event in your life, do this. And then the other one is called jyotish, when the calendar is a certain way, when it's a certain time, do this, you know. And that's Vedic astrology, is that the right time to do this kind of an activity is now. Or not now, or then. And it's based on the moon in the 27 nakshatras, 27 fixed stars, 27 lunar mansions. And the sun is involved. And the relationship between the sun and the moon is important. The rest of the planets, the five starry planets don't play a big role, are hardly even mentioned. The Rashis don't play a big role. They're hardly even mentioned. They're not mentioned.
Right. I mean, there's some argument about like, you know, a wheel with 12 spokes or something like that, that I know, I think David Frawley makes about trying to attribute sort of knowledge of the zodiac or of natal astrology to the Vedas based on that, but it's really kind of thin.
No, it's cool. It's true. They have it. Everybody knows that there's 12 months in a year. I mean, practically everybody looks at it that way. Mm-hmm. And there's some people that have 9 months, et cetera. They use different cycles. But practically every culture says, oh, there's 12 months in a year because it takes 12, the moon goes full 12 times more or less in the course of a year. So we divide into 12 and then you can measure time based on that. And that's what Rashis are. They have a calendar based on that. Also, it's a different kind of calendar. It's a calendar for different kind of ceremonies, planting ceremonies, harvesting ceremonies, things like that. But the old Vedanga Jyotish was like, when the moon is in this nakshatra, do this.
Right.
Do that.
So that's the indigenous sort of ancient astrology of India is the nakshatras. And that's something that you and all the tropicalists agree is sidereal because it's based on specific fixed stars, right?
Right. See, that's pretty amazing too, because Western astrology, as far as I know, already has this idea that there's fixed stars and then there's zodiac signs.
Right.
Right. And the fixed stars are at a certain point in relation to the zodiac, but that's true today, and 5,000 years it'll be in a different place. Aldebaran will be in a different place in 5,000 years, right? Relative to the zodiac, relative to Taurus, relative to wherever it is right now, right? So that's already a concept that's in Western astrology. It's just the same concept. It's just, if we just realize that nakshatras are the fixed stars, they are the stars. Aldebaran is Rohini. Mm-hmm. That's the Yogatara. That's the main star for Rohini.
Sure. So, and the assumption, I guess, that's often been made is that that's the reason why, because the Indian tradition had this strong sidereal component with the nakshatras, that that almost provides a premise for why they could have or would have stayed sidereal. Whereas in the Western tradition, once precessions started leading the zodiacs to diverge, why some of the Western astrologers went tropical for whatever reason, since perhaps they didn't have anything holding them back to that sidereal reference point, whereas maybe in the Indian tradition they did with the nakshatras. But you've argued that the zodiac should be seen as separate from the nakshatras, and that even the way that both sidereal and tropical astrologers conceptualize the zodiac is not completely aligned with the constellations, but instead it's just an idealized division of 12, right?
Right, right. And that's where the complication comes in, because you have to relate stars to signs if you want to do anything with the stars, because it's very, very difficult to measure where stars are. Mm-hmm. In old books, there's all kinds of errors all the time. And even today, NASA uses tropical coordinates for things. It's just so much more accurate and easy to get an accurate measurement from a tropical system. So that's why you have Ayanamsha, because you measure everything tropical and then you have to convert it to know how does this pertain to stars. Mm-hmm. So that's why I think that's why it becomes confusing, because you're going to have definitions in books that say, for example, like Bachakrana Bhav Vishuvat Dutiyam Samasutragam. This circle of stars is the core, the nabi, the core of the circle of stars is a line drawn between the two equinoxes. Bam. The core of the zodiac is the line that draws between the two equinoxes, and then Ayanam Chadutiyam, and also through the two solstices.
And that's from the Surya Siddhanta?
Siddhanta. Yeah, so there's tropical definition. But then you'll also hear in the same book, and Aries begins with Mesha, and Aries begins with Ashwini, or, you know, and then they'll start to say something like that. So in this one book, there's these two statements where that Aries begins when the sun crosses the equator heading north. And then in the same book, they say Aries begins with Ashwini.
So is that confusion then? Is that indicating some confusion or some nebulousness? Because one of the things you've pointed out is you go the further back in the tradition you go, the less of a difference there would be due to precession, that precession would be less. And so perhaps there could have been some confusion, or they could have used one placement or another and either not recognize the difference, or the difference may not have made a big difference at that point.
I don't think it's a confusion. I think it's a necessity. Like I say, you have to map the stars to the Rashis. You need to, mm-hmm. to do calculations. So in one place, we define what the Rashis are, and now we describe the relationship between the Rashis and the nakshatras.
Why do you need to connect to the Rashis with the, or the signs of the zodiac with the fixed stars at all, though?
Because how do you measure fixed stars without coming from a tropical measurement? All of the measurements are based on the lagna.
I mean, with the tropical, you just establish the equinoxes and the solstices, and then you're done. You can measure the zodiac, right?
Right. So that's now you're very easy. You have your grid of 360 degrees. Mm-hmm. To measure stars, it requires really, you know, all these equipments with these like, you know, angle measures and all these things, and you get it wrong anyway. That's why there's so much error, even in Surya Siddhanta, about trying to measure where these stars are. There's error of 1 to 4 degrees conspicuous everywhere.
Okay.
Because it's really hard to do measurements by eye to the stars. So it's much easier to do it from a tropical point of view.
Okay, right.
So they want, if you want to know about the nakshatras and where do they start and where do they end, the easiest way to do it is just describe it relative to the tropical scheme of 360 degrees. Okay. So that's why they have Ayanamshit, so that you can translate between one and the other.
Now I understand the point you're making. The point you're making is that even when modern or contemporary Indian astrologers calculate the sidereal placements, they'll first calculate the tropical placements, and then they'll offset for where the sidereal placements are relative to that. And that's what the Ayanamsha is it's a calculation or how much you do an offset relative to the tropical zodiac.
Right, right. And so that's why in old books, there's going to be a statement about what the... That's like saying this is the Ayanamsha when they say, hey, Aries and Ashwini. That's like saying that's the Ayanamsha right now.
Sure.
And in the, and those kind of statements would be the ones that would get updated when people would copy a book. Oh, this is no longer true. Let's change this. And that's why in the old, some of the old texts that have survived, you don't hear about Ashwini being first one. You hear about Kritika being the first one. Mm. And then, but then after a certain point, printing presses came. And even before that, dark ages came. People kind of forgot what's supposed to be updated, what's not supposed to be updated, what's a statement that's just an observation versus what's a statement that's a definition.
Sure. So one of your, I mean, you do acknowledge that for probably at least a good, the past several hundred years that the sidereal zodiac has been the primary zodiac used in India though, right?
Certainly, definitely.
Okay. So your argument though is just that both you think in the earliest textual tradition that that wasn't the case. And then there's sort of a separate practical argument in terms of how you feel that that's more effective just in terms of your personal practice as well.
Yeah. Yeah. See, the thing is to, I would just let people do their own thing. I mean, why would I care if somebody else wants to do sidereal zodiac? Doesn't bother me.
Sure.
But there's just this problem, this politics in the world. So like when you're a great teacher and you're the leader of such and such organization, and then some Joe comes around and says, but so-and-so over there says you're wrong. Even though so-and-so over there doesn't bother saying that you're wrong, but so-and-so just does it different. Or the guy says, hey, teacher, great Guruji, this Joe Schmo down the block says it's different than what you say. So then what happens with great Guruji is great Guruji says, well, that Joe Schmo is, well, that guy down the block is just a jerk. He doesn't, it's completely wrong. So that's what bugs me.
Sure. So that's where some of the debates come in is, I mean, because that's the tricky issue is when you're dealing with techniques like this or big, you know, what are essentially like conceptual or technical disputes, it becomes very personal very quickly because astrologers both sort of pattern their lives and their views of their own life on their charts, but also because that represents the system that they use on a day-to-day basis. And essentially, if you're arguing that the zodiac in one tradition is not one way, but it's supposed to be another, it sort of implies that you think that some people are using the wrong zodiac or something to that extent. And so people get defensive or they want to defend their practice.
Right. And then I get defensive.
Sure.
You know, because I'm also a human being. So then, but the thing is, you can use the wrong zodiac. That's fine. Because let's be honest, first of all, a lot of astrology is not math. A lot of astrology is your intuition, your feelings. A lot of astrology is just being a therapist, and being somebody for people to talk to, being somebody who's going to listen to somebody and say something kind to somebody. That's a good part of being a great astrologer. Mm-hmm. It has nothing to do with your calculation of this or that. And even if you go down the calculations, even if you change the beginning of Aries, there's still a lot of things that don't change.
Sure. Like the nakshatras, if you're using them sidereally, those stay the same. And even some of your timing techniques that are based on that stay the same, right?
Yeah. And other interesting things too, like the relationship between the planets, the geometric relationship between the planets doesn't change. You're changing them all the same amount. So all your aspects between planets stay the same, or, you know, at least they hold their own with a lot of integrity. They stay pretty much the same. The relationship of planets to the ascendant, it's going to stay the same because the ascendant's going to move also. Everything is moving the same amount. So a lot of things stay the same. That's why it's kind of uncanny how you can almost just interpret a chart, either one, sidereal or tropical.
Sure. And that becomes part of your sort of rationale for why maybe this, what you view as like an error in the tradition, has sort of persisted for so long, because in many major instances, it might not make a huge difference, or there may be ways to still use the system effectively without essentially using the correct zodiac from your viewpoint.
Yeah. And then I think it also leads to the what would you call it? Endemic, pandemic? I don't know. Thing that I have come from like a more Vedic background. I didn't go into astrology. Astrology is not my first foray into the Indian world. It's my latest one. So it's disturbing for me, actually. You just see this like endemic of like, well, we don't care about any, we don't care what the Vedas say. We don't care what they say. We do what works. Because that's what happens if you start, calculating something wrong, then you have to stop caring about what the classics say because you have to still make it work. So you have to have the freedom to adjust things. And so you'll find like a lot of what they say about planets is so mushy. You know, they always say like, but Mars debilitated is great. Well, what do you mean Mars debilitated? It goes completely against the whole theory of debilitation. You're going to say Mars debilitated is great because it's not really debilitated. It's supposed to be in Leo. But you're saying it's in Cancer, but you're making it work. So you're inventing some new theory that it's cancellation of debilitation, or because this quadrant of that and this didn't happen, then that's why this is not the way it's expected to be. Or actually, it's not so bad that it's debilitated because blah, blah, blah. So I think by having the wrong calculations, then it just sends the whole thing into the spiral where it's like, let's just do whatever works. Whatever works. Now you have, it's not a system anymore. It's not a science anymore.
Right. So you feel like the system may have been partially changed or adapted in order to make up for this change that's become more and more substantial over the course of the past 1,000 years or so.
Yeah. People are saying that the ninth house is the father.
Right.
Not the 10th house.
And actually, because Andrew Foss, so this whole debate, and I should actually mention him just because that was how I found this, was your response to his article, where I guess he wrote an article in the March 2017 issue of the British Association for Vedic Astrology Journal, where he criticized, and he didn't actually name, the assumption was that he was referring to Ernst Wilhelm, but he just sort of did a blanket criticizing of tropical users of Indian astrology, basically, where he brought up several points. And then you did a video responding to that. And that's actually how I first came across this again, after not following it for about 10 years. And that was one of the points that he brought up, is that he said, or maybe you could actually explain what his point was and then what your counterpoint was.
Yeah. Well, to be fair to him, I think what he's actually trying to say is to separate the nakshatras from the rashis is bogus. I think he's got a caveat that if you want to use tropical zodiac, that's fine. We love you too. But if you want to separate nakshatras from rashis, that's not fine. We can't tolerate that.
Right, because one of his issues is there's been a lot of like rationalizations about why the zodiac signs mean certain things in Indian astrology that have been argued that are tied in with the nature of certain nakshatras and their alignment with the zodiac. So for him, sort of unhinging the two or removing the two from alignment is a major problem conceptually.
Right. So for example, the thing that he brings up is Magga. Magga is this nakshatra of ancestors, Pitri. But its symbol is a throne, because it's about what you inherit. This nakshatra is about inheriting power. Mm-hmm. And so, and in the sidereal system, it's at the end of Leo.
Okay.
And so he says, so that's why Leo is Leo, because it has Magga in it. That's his way of thinking. But what about those other nakshatras in it? It also has other nakshatras that aren't Magga.
Sure.
So.
And what was the ninth house?
What about
house
those
thing?
Parts of Leo? Oh. But anyway, but my point to that is, isn't it because the sun owns Leo, that Leo is Leo? The sun owns Leo and it's fire and it's fixed.
Right. I mean, that becomes...
Why do you have to bring Magga?
Right. And that makes, you know, the astrologers often have different and sometimes overlapping rationalizations for why certain things mean certain things. And then when it comes to debates like this, a lot of those get sort of drawn out. And there's often a question of, you know, what is the actual real original motivation or rationale for this meaning? And, you know, was there just one, or were there multiple, or, you know, which one was more relevant?
Well, that's why I started off by saying epistemology is so important. Now you have two contesting ideas, and you have to have a system for how you're going to evaluate them.
Sure.
And the system that I would suggest, because it's accepted by all scientific institutions, is simpler solutions are better. Simpler solutions are better. And things which don't have contradictions are better than things which do.
Sure. So your objection then is there's a contradiction there, where if you're just focusing on the nature of one nakshatra, in Leo, you're ignoring the other two, and that's a bit of an issue.
Yeah, and also you're contradicting definitions. Where you're contradicting, in order to say that the nakshat, that Leo is Leo because his Magga is in it, you have to contradict the Surya Siddhanta and the Puranas, which say that Leo is Leo because it's, what is it? It's the second sign in after the sun gets to its most northerly point.
Right. That otherwise, yeah, at least in the northern hemisphere, corresponds with the height of summer. Although that's something that you object to. There's a bit of a debate there that I noticed that was interesting, because Foss was trying to say that the tropical zodiac still has some usage when it comes to talking about the weather or the seasons. Right. But you were responding saying you don't think the zodiac has anything to do with the seasons because you're aware of the issue of having to reverse it in the northern and southern hemisphere, and that's something that you want to avoid.
Well, they have, obviously, they have something to do with seasons because it's the progression of the sun through the months of the year. So obviously the weather changes. Mm-hmm. But that's not the core of what the signs are. The core of what the signs are is what planet owns it, what element is it made of, and what modality does the sun have while it's in it. Modality means like what direction does it move, what kind of movement does it have? Is it cardinal, fixed, or dual? Mm-hmm. And the fourth factor could be what sequence is it in from the starting point. Those are the four essential components of what makes a sign a sign. In the northern hemisphere, there's different kinds of weather. In India, it's a rainy season. Mm. It's not a hot season. Am I right? I think I'm right. You know, you got to check this. I might get my facts, my details wrong. But what I'm basically saying is there's no permanent correlation of specific weather to specific signs. It's all different in different places in the world. What the signs really are is the sun's going north and south of the equator, which regardless of where you are on the globe, the sun goes north and south of the equator. And because of that, it has different relationship to cardinal directions. And because of that, it has different relationships to elements associated with those directions. And because of that, it has different modes of movement. And then you just have the sun taking the most northerly point. It takes the most northerly point, which is fixed and fire. Not exactly the most northerly point, but it takes the point that it likes the most. Kings like the highest point. And then the rest of the planets just line up in their order of speed underneath them, taking rulership of the signs. So that's a simple description of the zodiac.
Sure. And so it becomes almost, I mean, the way that you present it in your video is almost, I don't want to say purely numerological, but there's almost like a numerological component to it in some sense, in terms of thinking more in terms of sequences and things like that, rather than tying it directly or closely into seasons.
Yeah. Why should you tie it into seasons? It's like saying smoking causes cancer, so cancer is part of what builds a cigarette. Cancer is not what builds a cigarette. Cigarettes are made of tobacco, but they have an effect that causes cancer. So the Rashi may have this effect that it's coincident with the beginning of summer in some part of the world, but that's not what makes the Rashi what it is. It's something that's coincident with it.
Yeah. I mean, then that was that's been the debate or something we've talked about on the podcast a few times. Because on the one hand, you do have authors like Ptolemy in the second century, where he's explicitly saying that because the days are the longest when the sun moves into Cancer and Leo, that the two luminaries or the two lights are assigned to those two signs of the zodiac, one to a feminine sign and the other to a masculine sign. And then the rest of the planets are assigned in zodiacal order from there. So there's almost some sort of rationale that's very much tied into what is essentially a seasonal component. But then there could be this other rationale that has to do with, you know, the amount of light that's being emitted or things like that. But it still runs into some issues in terms of the hemispheres. So
yeah, so he expressed it like that in terms of the longest day. But the way I just expressed it was, it's the most northerly point. Kings go to the highest point. The royalty goes to the highest point.
That makes sense, because that was the question then, is what would make, for example, Aries a viable starting point in both the northern and southern hemisphere? Or I guess, you know, from the perspective you're arguing, what makes 0 degrees Cancer and the first degree of Leo the point to sign the two luminaries to? And that would be your argument for that.
So it's almost exactly what Ptolemy says, except instead of saying it's because the days are the longest, which could be even a translation error, it could mean this is the highest point.
Sure.
I don't know Greek or whatever it was written in, so I can't say. But what I'm saying is this is the highest point, so the king goes there.
Sure.
And he doesn't go exactly to the highest point because he likes fire better than water because he's the sun. So he goes to the closest place that he likes.
You know? Right, right. Yeah, I mean, that's I mean, do you use masculine? You use masculine and feminine signs as well, right? It's like soft sure. and hard in the Avanajataka.
Yeah, fire is the most masculine and air is a little bit less masculine. Water is the most feminine.
Okay.
And earth is a little less feminine. And then as for Aries, zero Aries, this is the most important point. Because this is another thing. Like when you have a circle, circles are infinite. So where does a circle start and end? That's why it's confusing. The zodiac is a circle. So where does it start? Where does it end?
Right.
Well, you got to pick a spot. Well, you should pick a reasonable spot. Well, it's the same thing like a year. Where does a year start? Where does a year end? That's the same question. Where does a day start? Where does a day end? So things begin when they become visible to us. Things begin when the sun comes up. That's our basic symbolic association to beginning. Sunrise, sun coming over a horizon is something beginning. Now we can see things. They become real. So what you have in terms of a day is the sun begin. The day begins astrologically. It doesn't begin at midnight. Astrologically, the day begins at the sunrise. And then a year or the zodiac, which is a measurement of the year, begins when the sun rises. When the sun comes over the Earth's equator, heading up.
Okay.
Because north doesn't just mean north towards New York. North means up. South means down. So you get the plane of the sun relative to the Earth. So you got now you have a sense of up and down. Because you got a plane and something else like this. So the sun comes up and goes down. When the sun comes up over that plane, that's like a sunrise. Right? So that's what they'll say in mysterious ways in the Puranas. They'll say that the beings who dwell on the moon and this higher realm, they have a day which lasts for 6 months and a night which lasts for 6 months. You know, that's what they're talking about. There's another kind of day which is 6 months long and a night which is 6 months long. It's when the sun rises up over the ecliptic or the equator. When the sun rises over the equator, then it becomes daytime in that year. The day starts. That's the point of Aries. That's the vernal equinox, as we call it by convention. But it's just the northerly equinox, the upwards equinox.
Sure.
That makes sense. Should be the start point.
Yeah. I mean, and that provides an actual conceptual rationale for why you would want to use, you know, the vernal equinox as the starting point of the zodiac versus the other equinox. You know, I know we're running out of time here, so I want to make sure I get in some questions from some of my like sidereal friends or listeners who might have objections. So let's see, what would some of those be? I mean, what if the textual argument was removed? What if, it turned out that the textual argument was not there? Do you think that would change your mind or do anything significant to remove your adoption of this argument? If it turned out that the Indian astrologers circa, let's say, as early as the 7th century CE were using the sidereal zodiac for the Rashis, would that change things or is it really more of a practical consideration at this point or is it both?
No, with epistemology, there's three things to consider. There's Shabda or your source of information, which is like a text. Mm-hmm. Then there's Anuman, which means logic. The text has to conform with logic. It has to be comprehensible to logic. And then there's pratyaksha, which means experience. Mm-hmm. The experience will be clear, will be fuzzy if the logic and the education are not there. So you can't start from, if you start from pratyaksha, if you start from experience, you come up with anything that works.
Sure.
But if you start from text, then you understand it logically and then you can see it work very clearly. So if you remove the text, you still have logic. So here's the logic. Like, why are there 12 signs? Why aren't there 15? Why aren't there 53? Why are they equally sized? People will say, well, look, there's 12 constellations in the sky. Why are there 12 there? Because somebody picked it? Because some fanciful guy said, look, there's a virgin. And there's not 12, there's 13. We got that other one that I can't even pronounce. Ophiuchus.
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 Yeah.
And then you got this other question of why are they equal size? Virgo's what, 48 degrees or something?
Yeah, the actual constellation is 48 degrees is actually huge.
It's huge. And Pisces is like also ginormous.
Yeah. And Aries and Cancer, I think, are much smaller.
Yeah. And if you look at Scorpio, if you include the Officius guy, the 13th one,
right,
then you got the Scorpio's got squished down to 7.
Okay.
7 little tiny babies. So it's not because they're stars. That's my first logic. The second logic is, why do you have the sun? Why are the modes? Why does the sun cardinal in one place, fixed in another, dual in another place? Mm-hmm. If it's not, this is only explainable in relation to the movement, the equinoxes and the solstices. Why are there elements in certain places? This is only explainable relative to the cardinal directions, which is only explainable relative to the northern, southern solstices, and then the upwards and downwards equinoxes. So all the key points of many of the key points of what makes of the Rashis, the elements and the modes and their very nature, why they're 12 and why are they 30 degrees each, has no logical basis if it's just connected dots, stars. But it has a very compelling logical basis if it's all based on equinoxes and solstices. So even if you take out the text, it still makes it only, the argument is even stronger, actually.
Sure. Yeah. And it's like, I don't, you know, object as a tropical astrologer myself, but I want to make sure that I'm not, letting you get away without debating some of the points that maybe a sidereist would make if they were on the show right now. And I'm actually going to, I think as a follow-up to this, I'll probably interview Kenneth Bowser, who's a Western astrologer that argues for the sidereal zodiac. And I know you've responded to some of his arguments, because then he would be coming at it from the other perspective, you know, trying to make the best arguments he can. I can already anticipate one of the arguments that he would make is that he'll argue, and most Western sidereists will argue, that the zodiac originated as sidereal in the Mesopotamian or Babylonian tradition, with those constellations that were first recognized, where the planets would move through them on the ecliptic, and there were 18 of them or what have you originally. And then by the 5th century, they were standardized to contain 12 signs of 30 degrees each. And he'll argue that because they were already sidereal in the Babylonian tradition, that it was a mistake or an unfortunate change that happened later when astrologers switched to using the tropical zodiac at some point and divorced themselves from the constellation. So, I mean, I guess we've heard part of your response to that. I mean, is there any other response that you would make, I guess, outside of what you've already said?
It seems to me, because I'm not an expert on the Mula Pin and all that stuff, but it seems to me that it's very similar to the Nakshatra Rashi situation. If they didn't have 12 constellations, then they weren't talking about Rashis. They were talking about stars. They had 18 constellations.
Sure. Originally, although they did have by the 5th century BCE, by the time they developed natal astrology, they were using 12 signs of 30 degrees each. So by the 5th century BCE.
So where did they come up with 12 signs of 30 degrees each? Why didn't they stick with their 18?
Right. I mean, that is one of the, million-dollar questions. The academics usually say it was just a convenient measuring choice, but usually most astrologers would say that there's a deeper symbolic or divinatory meaning to that, or attribution to those 12 sectors.
Yeah. See, to me, it just seems like it's very, very similar to the Vedic situation. The original thing that they were doing was looking at stars. Mm-hmm. Because if you want to do astrology, it's not so exciting to do it during the day.
Right.
You can't see nothing but clouds and blue sky, but at night you see stars. So in India, they're looking at the moon relative to stars, and probably they're doing the similar thing in other parts of the world too. You look at stars when you look at the sky. So your first system, or the system that you rely on the most, is a system that has to do with sidereal things, stellar things. And then you start to think about how you measure things more accurately and whatnot. And then you start to put cones on the ground and measure shadows and come up with equinoxes. And then you come to a different way of thinking about things, that it's going to, that now we're measuring from the sun's movements relative to the earth. And now the question is, are they the same? Are these measurements the same? And then over time, or maybe since whatever, they realize that it's not the same.
Right. And so, I mean, when do you think that they did realize that it's not the same? Or when do you think that when do you acknowledge that the Indian astrologers probably did go sidereal by that specific point in time?
It seems like it's been for about 1300 to 1700 years.
So since the time of Varahamihira, like 7th century or so, 7th century CE?
It may have been always, because like you said, you have books like Yavana Jataka, and then you have Tajik Nilamani and things like that, which are obviously coming from other cultures in their very name. There's the name of the country that they come from. Tajik is Persia and Yavanna is like the Greek, the Mediterranean area. So, and these are like very, very seminal texts of the first time that you see natal astrology in India. Mm-hmm. So maybe they never even did, maybe they just right from the beginning, as soon as they started doing Rashi things, they just correlated it to their nakshatras and stuck with that.
Yeah, I mean, that's always been my assumption, but that, I guess that's why I've been interested in this argument that Ernst made, and now more and more people like yourself are making, that perhaps there was this tropical component early on, and you guys do point to some of these interesting things, you know, like a reference in the Avana Jataka or like a reference in an astronomical text like the Surya Siddhanta, where they may have been defining things tropically like some of the Western astrologers were doing. And then there is a question of, you know, what does that mean? Does that mean some of the astrologers were doing tropical? Does that mean it's just the astronomers that are sometimes defining things tropically, but the astrologers are doing things sidereally? That's kind of the question I'm curious about.
Well, astronomy and astrology didn't become divorced until one became silly and the other remained scientific. They used to be the same thing. You would have to calculate your chart before you could interpret it. So whatever an astronomer would be calculating would be what an astrologer is going to be looking at. They're not like they're two different disciplines.
I mean, maybe. I mean, at least in the Western tradition, you do sometimes have astronomers just like today who are, you know, doing astronomy or just purely for the calculation, versus sometimes there's astrologers who are about the interpretive art. And I think at least in the fourth century.
That's today though, right?
Well, I mean, even in the Western tradition, the fourth century, there's a reference in one of the astronomers, Theon of Alexandria, who lived around 415, who seems to be really interested in doing the calculations, but he says astrologers would go to him to learn how to use Ptolemy's tables so that they could calculate birth charts, but that they weren't really well versed in the mathematical astronomy. So there may have been a diverse sort of division between the astrologers and the astronomers much earlier than we sometimes think, just because they are sometimes different practices. I mean, as soon as you have like the invention of an ephemeris, you know, you don't necessarily have to be able to observe the stars in order to calculate them, because you have tables that'll tell you where the planets were. So at that point, you know, astronomy and astrology can at least theoretically or could start diverging.
Sure, you have specialists. People will specialize in this and specialize in that. But who's writing the ephemeris that the astrologers are using? The astronomers.
Right.
So, I mean, astrology is always based on interpreting astrological calculation. I mean, reverse that. Astrology is always based on interpreting astronomical calculations.
Right.
Always.
But just to play devil's advocate, just as the modern astronomers define, you know, 0 degrees of Aries as the vernal equinox, even though they don't believe that that has any actual relevance, they're just using that as a reference framework. You know, I could see somebody making the argument that whatever astronomer wrote the Surya Siddhanta 1,000 years ago also was just using that as a reference or a framework, and that may not necessarily, unless you have it in a specific astrological text, reflect what the astrologers were doing. So, you know, I could just at least see that as an argument somebody could make.
Yeah. Well, I think it's wrong to say that the Surya Siddhanta is not an astrological text. In India, astrology is thought of as having three components: Gyanic, Horik, and Nimit. So Gyanic is the science part. The astronomy part is Gyanika Jyotish. And then the Hora part is the interpretive stuff, but it's also calculative interpretation. Like all the formulas for calculating dignity, prominence, bala, strength, all this stuff. And nimitta, it means how you just interpret things with intuition, using the intuition. So the astrology has three components in the Indian mind: intuition, interpretation, and calculation, and they're not divorced. The only people want to say they're divorced because people, this was, you know, if somebody disagrees with you, you say, well, they're irrelevant. But they're not irrelevant. Astrology is based on astronomy, and astronomy is a part of astrology. It's the foundation of astrology. It's like if you say, I'm a tarot card reading, but I don't use tarot cards.
Right. Yeah, you made that point in a comment. I forget what you were responding to, but it was actually a really good point. Do you remember what you originally made that point in reference to?
Yeah, people, just to people saying this, that Surya Siddhanta is not about astrology, it's about astronomy. And we're super science, And we don't rely on science. We rely on our intuition. And you have to rely on all three.
Right. That was it. You were responding to some people who say you're focusing too much on the calculations, and astrology is not right. about that. It's about something bigger. It's not just science. It's bigger than science. And so you responded saying, no, calculation is important, because it's like, you know, if you were to just attempt to read tarot cards without having a deck of cards, you have nothing.
Yeah. All three have to be there. You definitely need intuition. It's so important. And a whole bunch of other things like manners, caring, heart, love. So much. So that's all totally important. And then you also need some system of interpretation. That's Hora. Like, what system will you use to sort out all these symbols? How are you going to prioritize them, and which ones are you going to look at first? And then you need calculations. If one of those three is missing, then you're weak. You're like an animal without all its legs.
And I mean, just returning back to that point, though, I mean, do you feel like most modern astrologers, most contemporary astrologers have sufficient background in the astronomy of how planetary motions and other things work to calculate a chart?
No, that's what also makes this really hard, is most people will get into arguments about things that they're not qualified to get into arguments about. And then when I say that, I look like a big jerk, like a big pompous jerk. But I'm just saying, like, you shouldn't get into an argument about something that you're not qualified to argue. It's like, it would be silly for me to like argue the Greek in Ptolemy's Tetrabiblios, because I don't know anything about Greek. So people don't even know what sidereal means. Like, what does this Latin word sidereal mean? It means stars. And what does tropical mean? It means turning, how the sun turns, moves in a circle. Or what does nakshatra mean? It means stars. And what does Rashi mean? It doesn't mean stars. It means a bunch of light.
Sure. I mean,
a bunch of rush.
At what point do you feel like if you agree that that's the case now, at what point do you feel like that became the case where astrologers aren't necessarily proficient in astronomy or are not necessarily astronomers?
Well, I don't know. I think I just got a good idea from you, because you just said, like, if you go all the way back to the ephemeris, you know, as soon as somebody publishes an ephemeris, you don't have to do it yourself.
Yeah. I mean, I've argued that that's the point at which astrology and astronomy started diverging, and that it was much earlier than we usually assume it was, that we assume, you know, because you have figures like Ptolemy, who is a famous astronomer as well as an astrologer and wrote books on both, that all of the astrologers were fully proficient in both. But I've been surprised that that may not always have been the case.
But even if you did, you've done charts by hand?
Yeah.
So it's like, it's pretty, your mind gets sharpened by trying to do that. So even that, having an ephemeris, it seems like, oh no, you know, now you're not an astronomer anymore. But even if you just use an ephemeris, you have to do a lot of math, and you have to have a lot of patience, and you have to follow systems and have a logical mind to be able to just calculate a chart. So it would be great if people would even just go back to using an ephemeris. That would make everything a lot more scientific and logical.
Right. Yeah.
But now we have programs. And that's the whole thing that got me into this thing with Andrew Foss, because he just said that he released a new edition of his software. So I just asked him, did you put in the option to make the Rashis independent from the nakshatras? Mm-hmm. And he said, no, I don't believe in that. See this article. And I just thought, man, you won't even put this in your, like, people who write astrology software don't have to like believe in every option that they put in their software. You put it in just in case. You're an astrology software. You should enable research. People are going to, right? So I just thought, wow, that's really weird.
So that was the genesis of that whole sort of back and forth between you and him?
Yeah. Like, you're so against this that you won't even consider it or allow other people to consider it.
Sure. And so that has had actual ramifications for you, just in terms of your relationship with other Vedic astrologers.
Yeah. How did you know that?
I've seen some discussion recently about some of your videos and stuff, just in terms of people seem to have very strong reactions, either in support or sort of against what you're saying. And it's very rarely like somewhere in the middle.
I wish it was about what I was saying. That would be awesome. I would be so turned on by that. But it's not about what I'm saying. It's just about me, which is such a joke. Who cares about me? I'm going to be dead in a couple of years, or maybe hopefully more than a couple of years, but who cares about me? You know, sure, I'm abrasive, whatever. I have Mercury and whatever, you know, my Mercury is really, really strong and harsh. Fine. I apologize for that, or whatever, or you can love that if you want. But that's not the important point. The important point is what I'm saying. If people would actually be talking about what I'm saying, then I would feel really happy. But people don't. They just say, oh, this guy's a jerk. He's not being nice. Being nice? What do you mean being nice? I am being nice. I like you. I just want to talk about this point. I don't even know Andrew Foss. You know, I'm not talking about Andrew Foss. I'm talking about this thing that he wrote in his article. The concept that he spoke in his article is what I'm addressing. He might be the nicest guy in the world, or he may not. I have no idea, and it doesn't matter. I might be a jerk, or I might not be a jerk, but it doesn't matter. Can we please talk about science? Can we please talk about ideas? Can we, right? That's what bothers me.
Sure, just because it becomes very personal very quickly, just because people are very invested in, you know, whatever the correct answer is or whatever answer they've chosen.
And that's what I hate. They're invested in it, and that word investment actually has a nice connotation of financial investment. You know, they're very financially invested in their position of being unchallengeable guru, even though they'll say, I'm not guru, but they're taking the position of guru, and there are so many students. No, I don't do any readings, but they do readings. And no, I don't make any money about this, but they charge for everything. But then because they do nice, everybody thinks, well, this guy's so nice, but this Vic guy over here, he's such a jerk.
Right.
So abrasive.
I mean, that's a really funny and interesting point, just because I've seen this crop up in other areas in the astrological community in general, where there's almost a political component to it, where people do, typically everybody adopts either what their teacher did, or they adopt the system that they think works the best for them. And it's usually one of those two, but there's often a reluctance to say, you know, this approach, I think it works best, and other approaches are wrong. Or sometimes, because from like a political standpoint, people want to be open and like embracing of other approaches or other cultures or other things like that. Sometimes in astrology, it almost becomes taboo to say, you know, no, I think that this is the best approach, or this approach does not work. And that's one of the things, right, I thought was interesting about your debates, is you've been very open about saying, I think that this is the best approach, and these are the reasons. And sometimes other people have either, you know, chastised you for that because they think you're wrong and that you're using the wrong approach, or they've sort of criticized you for saying that there is one right approach, and that
you got it.
It's not that all approaches are equally correct, but that you're saying that there is a specific approach that is correct and an approach that is wrong.
You got it. And you know what? I'm actually fine with this idea of you're okay, I'm okay, right? I'm fine with that idea. I can roll with that idea. But can you please also apply to me? Like, if you're okay, I'm okay, then how about I'm okay? And my idea, then, and there's no need for you to like debunk my system of saying that nakshatras and rashis are separate.
Sure.
Yeah. So these people are this guy, Andrew Foss, published this article, criticizing my system, but I'm the guy who's the critical one. I don't know why, because I speak more clearly and I say it more, and I'm not afraid to name a name. And this is the thing that bothers me. We should name people's names, because people should be accountable, not just amorphous person. So-and-so is a bad guy, and these bad guys are out there. Name the person who it is, so we can go and investigate this person and talk to that person directly. And that person has a chance to respond. But when I name a person, people feel like I'm attacking people.
Yeah, it is interesting observing the two approaches. And it was, I was surprised that he seemed to refer or allude to somebody who was promoting the use of the tropical zodiac in the Indian tradition without naming him. And I thought that was a little bit strange.
Yeah, and we don't promote our thing either. Like neither Ernst, nor Ryan, nor myself, nor Michael, definitely. We don't like promote, right? Like, we're not on a crusade, like going around like saying, you guys are wrong. Everybody has to switch to this new system. We say, we use this system. And then when people say, why do you use it? We explain it.
Sure. I mean, there is something where you are implicitly, if not explicitly, saying that other Indian astrologers are wrong, in that you've said, I think this is the correct zodiac, and the other one is not correct or not accurate or not going to give as effective results. So there's an implicit sort of challenge there that some could take. But I guess it is a question of whether they engage with you and how they engage with you, and then what your response is to that.
Yeah, well, Chris, let's look at it this way. I bet you when you go back and listen to this interview that I've done, I've said a couple of things at least that are wrong. I probably got some name of somebody wrong, or I maybe skipped some word or messed something up wrong. So there's a different wrong. People can be wrong. That doesn't mean they're totally wrong. Right. So yeah, I'm saying that the sidereal zodiac is wrong. That I'm not saying that Andrew Foss is wrong. I'm not saying that a reading from Andrew Foss is junk. I'm saying that the sidereal zodiac is wrong. That's one part of the way some people do their calculations, but they probably also have a way of making it work. You know, you don't need to use like a certain brand screwdriver to turn a screw. You can use a different brand. You can even use a wrench if you're really ingenuous, if you have a good ingenuity to turn a screw, pliers or something.
Sure. Well, yeah. And I don't, I mean, you don't have to back down, you know, too much on that, because that's part of why I'm interested in this as a topic, because it's one of those areas where I've had other debates in the past where people, you know, have used that as a rhetorical device to say all systems work and you're wrong for arguing that there's one particular approach. And sometimes when it comes to debates like this, I'm personally, honestly, not sure what the correct thing is. I personally use the tropical zodiac myself, and I think it makes more sense conceptually and also works better in practice, sort of like you. But I don't know if that means that the sidereal zodiac is, you know, not correct, or if it could be used in a different way that's still effective, but from a different perspective that I'm not seeing, perhaps. I don't really know personally what the answer to that is. I just know that the tropical zodiac works better for me, and so that's what I use and advocate. Yeah. But it's
go ahead. Oh, sorry. I get animated. Maybe because we need to end soon.
But yeah, we're going to say
two closing things. I think it does work. Like I said, people can make things work. But then you get all kinds of things adjusting to make this work.
Right.
And so that's not so cool. It's better to make it work cleanly than to make it work with a whole bunch of, you know, patches and new connections between things. The other thing that I want to say is, on the point of whether or not there is a right or wrong, right? My feeling on that is, you just divorce it from everything and just look at it logically. Like, as you said, you just said, some people say, you know, you're wrong for saying that one thing is wrong.
Right.
So there you go.
Or that astrology is divination and everything will work because, you know, there's something else about it that's not purely about the external thing. I mean, there's different arguments along those lines.
Astrology is divination, so anything will work. It's just saying that it's only intuition.
On some level, or that you can make anything work as long as you're systematic about it. It's not like a very clear argument usually.
Yeah. Okay. I can agree with that. But that doesn't mean that the zodiac, that doesn't mean that red is not red and orange is not orange. You can make red work. Like, you can wear red and it can work. Or you can wear orange and make it work. Change the way you walk or something, or change the sunglasses that you combine with it. But it doesn't mean that red is not red and orange is not orange. So I'm not saying that these people that things don't work with the sidereal zodiac. I'm just saying that the zodiac is inherently tropical.
Right.
You can make it work. If it's not, that's fine. And if you want to say, like, there's no right or wrong, well, that you've just already contradicted yourself, because you say, well, if you say there's no right or wrong, you just said what's right.
Right. That it's only right that there is no right or wrong.
No right or wrong. So right. Then that can't be true.
Sure. Okay. Well, that might be a good note, because I know we got to wrap up here in the next few minutes. So I wanted to mention your website. So what is your website again?
It's just my name, Vic Dicara, vicdicara.com.
And you've been killing it on YouTube over the past few years. Your channel is amazing. Really? And you just, in terms of your videos and your output, and seeing them sort of grow over the past few years. And it's just great. So I recommend people check out your channel. Do you know what your URL is for that?
Well, first of all, thank you. That's cool. Great to hear. And I think the channel name is Vic Dicara's Astrology. Vic Dicara's, Dicara's Astrology. Or just go to YouTube and search Vic Dicara.
Yeah, and I'll put a link to the YouTube channel and to your website on the description page for this episode. And then are you giving any talks this year or speaking at any conferences or anything?
Yeah, this is nice. I'm going to speak in Sedona at the conference in Sedona, the Vedic Astrology Conference in Sedona, which is really nice. And I give a shout out to Dennis Harness for being a really upstanding person. You know, he's not a tropical guy, But he's not involved with all this stuff, politics. Oh, no, we don't want Vic there because he's a rabble rouser. And I'm not going to rabble rouse there unless somebody provokes me.
Yeah, no.
I'm going to talk about nakshatras.
That's awesome. Yeah, I'm really glad to see that you're speaking there. That looks like a great lineup at that conference in Sedona later this year. I think it's in October, and I'll put a link for that in the description page for this. Dennis is awesome, and I'm hoping to have him on the show sometime soon. He was actually my teacher in Vedic astrology when I first learned it. So yeah, good luck with that. And thanks for joining me today.
Thank you, Chris.
All right. And thanks everyone for listening, and we'll see you next time.
Thanks, everyone.